return from Babylonian captivity last week. So we're entering into, I can figure out if this thing works, a history of Israel between the Testaments 1, which means there's going to be at least one more. So I don't know how this is going to work, but I'll get to what we mean by between the Testaments in just a minute. But Ron, could I get you to lead us in prayer before we start the lesson, please? I'd like to go back to a slide we had last week, talking about the Persian kings. Pretty soon we're going to get into the Greek king, but that didn't happen suddenly. I mean, turned out the Persian, these three, actually four kings, had some encounter with the Greeks before they took over the world, if you will. So, actually, just a little bit over those. If you remember, Cyrus II or Cyrus the Great expanded the Medo-Persian Empire to the greatest empire the world had known at that time. And he kind of pushed the Medes aside and took over the whole thing. Darius, let's skip down to Darius. He was king at the time of Ezra. He actually caused to happen the decree given out by Cyrus, which had kind of fallen into disuse. And, so he made that happen by building the temple. Whereas Cyrus was a great guy for, you know, expanding the kingdom, capturing people, Darius was more of, he worked on the infrastructure and the administration part of the government. And he built palaces and he built temples and all sorts of stuff like that. We have some things today. He built what might be called the first interstate highway system. From Susa all the way over to the Mediterranean Sea, about 1,600 miles, great road. He put in place the first postal system. This little thing up there in quotes, that's on the main post office building in New York City. That was actually coined by a Greek historian named Herodotus, who described the Greek postal system. Now, Darius, along this great road he built, he had stations all along, and each one of those stations he had men and horses. And he could send mail, he could send messages, he could send decrees from one end to the other, 1,600 miles. There's over 1,600 miles, and he could cause something to be delivered in 9 days. Okay, it would take people on horses and camels 3 months to cover that. It was quite efficient. He did a lot of gardens and stuff like that. A great place called Persepolis he built. Had a lot of monuments and stuff like that. And some of the gardens and stuff that he did are even copied today. He tried to encroach on Greece. He built a bridge, actually, across this place called the Dardanelles, a little narrow strip of water between Europe and Asia Minor. He built this bridge across there. Went over, it wasn't very successful. He came back. I think the bridge fell down. But anyway, he didn't do much harm to the Greeks. Xerxes, on the other hand, he wasn't, he tried to expand. He had all the money in the world, it turned out. He had gotten all the money left over from Darius, and he taxed everybody in his kingdom, so he did lots of money, lots of people, and he decided that he would go in and take over Greece. And he took an army that supposedly, some people estimate he had 2.5 million soldiers. That's a lot of people back in those days. He had a great navy. So he went over, his ships took him over. He overran Greece, took it over for a while, but his ships got wiped out. And he didn't have, he couldn't quite support his troops, so he wound up going back home without capturing Greece. Artaxerxes, he's the guy that Nehemiah was the cupbearer to. He tried a little bit, but his approach was a little different. He tried giving money to enemies of Greece and hoped they would weaken them, and he would eventually come over and take over. But that didn't work either. Darius too wasn't well liked by his people, so he spent a lot of his time trying to quell revolt. People that trying to overthrow him as the king. So he didn't try to fight the Greeks. He actually allied with them during the Peloponnesian War. So that kind of addresses those kings that we're familiar with from the scriptures. Now, there's a gap in there that there were some other kings between here and the time that Alexander the Great came on the scene, but we won't talk about them, if you will. Here's the empire. It goes all the way from India to Libya. You can hardly see that little strip of little mark there in the middle of it. That's his great road, if you will. That's Darius's road. It was the biggest empire the world had known up to that time, and persisted in being the biggest empire until Alexander came along. Malachi closed the Old Testament in two respects. It's the last book in terms of placement within the Old Testament, and presumably the last book in terms of time that he wrote his book. It was pretty clearly after the temple was established, because one of the themes of his book was condemning the people of Israel for not following the proper temple worship and some other things that they were doing. But he kept referring to how they were not following the proper temple worship. He also talked about the coming of the Messiah as if it were more or less near-term event. He also said that Elijah. He talked about the coming of Elijah, presumably referring to John the Baptist. Okay, and so that's it. That closed the book, and we got about 400 years between his book and the birth of Christ. You go back to 1 Samuel, the third chapter, and the word of Jehovah was rare in those days. There was no open vision. That kind of describes the situation for these 100 years, as far as we know. There were no scripture to record, that we consider properly contained in the Bible that talks about any revelation from God. Now, there are some that say, there was some. And some things are written about. But they weren't considered, I guess, authentic enough to be included within the scripture. What we know, we can go back and look at some of the prophecies from the Old Testament, and that points to some things within the period we're studying, and we can link those together. So we can learn some things there. The Apocrypha. That's where there were 14 writings, books, whatever you want to call them, that were included in the original Bible, if you will. But over time, they were considered not canon, if you wouldn't use that term, and were discarded from the King James Version. I can't remember if some or all those are in what's called the Catholic Bible, so some people still honor those. But we can learn a lot from the Apocrypha historically. That's kind of pick and choose about what's true and what's fantasy. Josephus wrote two books, history books, and they contain a lot of information about this period of time, and some of that's reliable and some of it's not. Dead Sea Scrolls, discovered in 1940-something, they have some of the scriptures, and they also have some additional information, tells a little bit. People have been digging around over there, for the last 200 or 300 years, archaeologists, and they're finding stuff that shed some light on that period of time as well. So, and then you got secular history. We're talking about Herodotus, who wrote that inscription in some New York post office. He was a Greek historian that wrote a lot about that period of time in history. So take all that together, we can get, a fairly clear picture of a lot of things that went on, particularly as it applied to the Jews or the nation of Israel. So let's go back. Here, Daniel had a lot of prophecies, and there we could, we'll talk about these couple of prophecies from 8th chapter of Daniel. We could spend two or three lessons starting about chapter 11, which actually talked a lot about some of the things that happened during the time we were studying, but that's a little too hard to go at the speed we want to go and go back and do those. But, you know, if you go back to Nebuchadnezzar's great image that he saw and Daniel's interpretation of that, then the third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth, we think that's the Greek. That's Greece. And then we go down to Daniel 8, verse 20 and 21. The ram which you saw having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia, and the shaggy goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. That's Alexander the Great. We didn't spell it out, but that's pretty pretty clear that he's talking about Greece and he's talking about Alexander the Great. So, before we get to Alexander, let's talk a little bit about... Is this fuzzy a little bit, or is it my... It is what it is. Yeah. So is that my writing, or... Okay, anyway. You know, back when I was a boy, I went to high school, we had a class or two on what's called Western Civilization. Well, we studied Western Civilization. I don't know if we do that these days or not. But a great part of that actually was devoted to the Greeks, who... they started a lot of things that led to what is now Western civilization. In all of these areas. Well, it's just too hard. Oh, that's better. Oh, my. That's better. Oh, I don't have to change my glasses. So there we go. Language, arts, literature, philosophy, sculpture, architecture, mathematics. They were leaders in all those areas during that time and forward. Many great men, if you studied Western Civ, you saw a lot of these names. You know? Being a mathematician, I'm particularly familiar with Pythagoras and Euclid. I'm sure any of you studying your math know about the Pythagorean theorem. You know, a lot of those... great mathematical concept came out of the Greeks. Alexander was educated by Aristotle, who inspired him to spread Greek culture. He run across the term Hellenism as we go forward in all the areas he conquered. And we'll find that Greek culture, particularly Hellenism, will play a great part in the evolution of Jewish religion. Hellenism. It basically, has these components, if you will. Talk about culture and all these arts and sciences and stuff. Language. You know, by the time of Christ, Greek was kind of the standard language all around the Mediterranean, part of the civilized world. Government. They kind of evolved the pattern of government in which people used forward. City design. They invented the concepts of streets intersecting at right angles, and kind of use that to lay out cities. Marketplace, each city had an agora at the center of town, which was a place where people came and bought and sold and traded. They had amphitheaters. Most cities of a decent size had an amphitheater, horseshoe thing, on the side of a hill with seats at the sea, maybe 10,000-15,000 people. And you can still see some of those if you go over there. And even though Alexander, he had just started it before he died off, but most of his followers, including the Romans, kind of followed the pattern that he had started and the precepts that are embodied in Hellenism. Let's talk a little bit about his daddy, Philip of Macedonia. We'll get to a little saying down here in a little bit earlier about it. If the Greeks could get together, they could rule the world. Well, he was going to try to do that. So he defeated most of the Greek city-states. They invented a lot of new weapons at that time that made them successful, both weapons and tactics and strategy, if you will. He united them under his rule and combined Greek troops with his Macedonian troops to form a pretty army. And then he began to conquer new areas. Unfortunately, or fortunately, we don't know. He was assassinated when he was 46. So the question was, would he have been successful as Alexander? We don't know if Alexander. But he was done in pretty early. And age 20, Alexander took over as the leader of the Greeks. Now, he wasn't a novice. He had been sent off by his father to command various troops and armies and rule over things from the time he was 18. So he didn't start fresh, but 20 is still pretty young, you know, to take over an army. And this is kind of the kingdom. You see Macedonia up there, and I don't know if it's yellow or green, I'm colorblind, but the city-states that are organized under him are shown there. Sparta didn't join up. Thessaly was a little held back a little bit, but he got most of these all together under him, along with his troops and their troops. So he had a pretty good army. Alexander, he was a Macedonian, but then, you know, the Macedonian and the Greek weren't necessarily buddies. But he culturally was a Greek, so he believed in all this Greek stuff. Aristotle taught him a lot of stuff, and he dreamed of the national glory that Philip started after. He carried the Iliad and the Odyssey around with him, read that all the time. And he wanted to be one of those heroes, and he almost was. Aristotle was the one that said the Greeks might govern the world could they but combine into one political society. Alexander set out to do this, if you will. Okay, so eventually this is what his empire came to be. And see that solid line in the middle? That's the path he followed. And can you see that? I'm going to kind of take you through some of the high points of that solid line, if you will. He started and went over, you know, this little, the Dardanelles, this little narrow strip of land between Europe and Asia Minor. Way up here on the left, and then you had the top. Okay, is it working? Oh yeah. All right, he started right here, and this—if I could expand this—this is that little body of water. You could almost jump across it, but not quite. But he came across in boats, and Darius actually built a bridge across there when he went over to Tarsus. But he had a, you know, it wasn't a big force. He had some Macedonians and some of those Greeks, and he came over. And even though it doesn't show up here, supposedly he captured Troy. Which, I don't know if it was the Troy of the Iliad, but he captured a place called Troy. And finally went down to a place called Granicus River. Now, the Greeks knew he was coming. But they didn't take him very seriously, so they didn't send a very big army, like a few of the cavalry, and basically some Greek mercenaries. And I don't know if you can see Granicus River. But anyway, he defeated him right away. He had a smaller force. Rather than do some feints or, you know, he just attacked him head on, split him. He was hit in the head with an axe, almost killed, but before the guy could strike the second blow, one of his men took the guy out. But anyway, he defeated the Greeks there pretty soundly. He was, you know, pretty well having his way down through there until he got down. You can barely see it. I can't make this thing work. Right above Cyprus, there was a place called Issus. The Persians organized, and they were going to stop him there. Weren't very successful. They withdrew, and he went on down to I'm trying to think for what's the capital of Syria? Oh, Damascus. He went down to Damascus, surprised the Persians there. They all ran off, and he actually captured some of the royal family. Okay, his next target was Tyre. Let's do a little history on Tyre, if you will. Let's go back and look at the prophecy of Ezekiel. at the time of Nebuchadnezzar and destruction of Jerusalem and all that, Tyre was on the mainland in Phoenicia, leading the world in shipping and all that stuff around the ocean. Ezekiel said, "Son of man, because Tyre is set against Jerusalem, aha, she is shattered, the doors of the people she has turned to me, I shall be filled, she is laid waste. So the Lord Jehovah says this, behold, I am against you, O Tyre, and will cause many nations to come up against you, as the sea causes waves to come up, and they shall destroy the walls of Tyre and break down her towers. For so says the Lord Jehovah, behold, I will bring Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, on Tyre, a king of kings from the north, etc., etc." This was about 13 years after the destruction of Jerusalem that Nebuchadnezzar came up. Now, the Tyrians, or whatever you call the Tyre people, they knew he was coming, and the kind of the chief people evacuated the city on the mainland and went over to a little island. It was about a half mile off the coast. So by the time that Nebuchadnezzar got there, most important people were gone, but he destroyed the place anyway. Just left it in a pile of rubble. On down in verse 12, you'll get the last part, and they shall lay your stones and your timber and your dust in the midst of the water. Now that, people think, is a reference to what Alexander did. Now he came down, and he there was an altar out there. He wanted to go out and sacrifice something on this altar. And he asked permission, sent some emissaries over to Tyre. And he said, no, they had a 150-foot wall on the land side of their city, and they didn't think he could do much damage to him, so they killed his emissaries and threw them in the water. So that made Alexander very mad. So he took all the wreckage left over from Nebuchadnezzar destroying the city and built a causeway half a mile from the land out to the island. Went out, used some of his war machines, went up over the wall, killed 8,000 men, sold all the women and children as slaves. So he took care of the Tyre people as well. Here's what Tyre looks like today, or it did to what we were in from satellite picture. So now, if you look at this little strip, here's an artist rendering. That little strip in the middle is what the thing that Alexander built looked like, a little strip of land. But it was enough to get him and his soldiers and his war machines over there to destroy the place. Okay, next could have been Jerusalem. You know, there's question about the stories that revolve around Alexander meeting the Jews in Jerusalem. He started up, and he was going to destroy the place. He already told his soldiers they could pillage the place, torture the chief priest and all that. But on his way up, he saw this procession coming out. And there was the chief priest dressed in purple and the other priests in white. And turns out, supposedly he'd had a dream the night before of such a procession coming out. And so he changed his mind and decided, well, he didn't think he would harm those people. Now Josephus said this, and when the book of Daniel was shown him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the Persians, he supposed that himself was that person intended, and as he was then glad, he dismissed the multitude for the present. But the next day he called them to him and asked what favors they did. So he decided that it hurt him. He said, well, what can I do for you? And this is again from Josephus. So they asked if they might enjoy the laws of, in other words, live under their own religious law. They wouldn't pay tribute the seventh year. And the Jews in Babylon and Media enjoy their own laws. And supposedly he said he would do what they wanted. And whether he did that, don't know, but supposedly there was a good relationship between the Jews and Alexander until the time of his death. So. Okay, back to the map. From he's on his way to Egypt. He decided he's going to conquer Egypt, you know, as he comes down and capturing all his land and his wife. So he gets down to Gaza. Their city is located on a kind of a high place, and they've got a big wall, and so they decided they'd fight rather than just cave in. So they had a 3-month siege, and he won. He was wounded again, this time in his shoulder instead of his head, but he survived that. Went on down into Egypt, and he was gladly received. They were tired of the Persians, and they received him pretty gladly. He went through the capital at that time, I think it was Memphis. He went up and established at least the layout for the city of Alexandria, which became the principal city of Egypt later after his death. He wanted to go down to the oracle of Ammon, down in Lydia, and see what the oracle said about his possible heritage going back to Zeus. So he went down there, and he claimed that the oracle said he was indeed descended from Zeus, and that he was going to conquer the world. So that made him real happy. And so he came back, kind of retraced his path back, and I can't read that map. He encountered Darius up at a place called Gagamela. You can see that up there. You've got better eyes than I have. So they encountered Darius again, defeated their army. Darius got away. One of his generals decided that it would be better if he wasn't around when and the Greeks were coming pretty fast. So he killed Darius. Alexander, when he caught up with him and found out what happened, was greatly disturbed because he thought Darius deserved better treatment. So he gave him basically a hero's funeral and then killed the other guy. So they're pretty bad details. So with that, the rest of Persia was open. So he went from Gaugamela, I guess the way you pronounce that, but you can't hardly see it there, down to the other capitals and took them over as he went. Babylon, Susa, Persepolis. We get down to Persepolis. That was a great, magnificent city that the Greeks had built. He burned it, completely destroyed it, because when Xerxes came over, he destroyed the Acropolis. So as a retaliation, he destroyed Persepolis when he came to it. Went on up to Ecbatana, and from there all the way over to India. And by that time, his troops had decided they wanted to go home. So it wasn't a full-fledged revolt, but they decided they didn't want to go any further into India or China or whatever was left. So he turned back. Came back to Babylon and was going to make that his capital, but he contracted a serious fever, some sort of a disease that was not clearly explained, and died there in Babylon. So that left a problem. What to do? He didn't clearly have a successor defined. So it was divided up into four pieces, if you will, amongst his four generals, leading guys that support him during this time. And let's go on over to the biggest, most important parts of this are the Seleucid kingdom and the Ptolemaic kingdom, particularly as it applies to the Jews. But you can barely see up there, there's the division between these actually crosses Palestine. So you can see the Jews were kind of in the middle of things. Now it turns out, under the initial division, Seleucid was supposed to get Palestine. But while they were kind of dickering around about how things were going to fall out, Ptolemy came up and basically settled there, took over the land. So for the next, however many years, or 100 years, the Ptolemies actually were in charge of Palestine and the overlords of the Jews. But there was a constant battle between, and there were many battles between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. You know, the Seleucids, they went back and forth between calling themselves Seleucus and the Antiochus. And it's hard to know who you're talking about when you're reading about them. But anyway, the Ptolemies from Egypt were in charge down until about 198. And then the Seleucids switched over. And I'll cover a little bit of that on each side, but I want to get down to Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, before we get into much detail. This guy by the name of Aristides wrote this thing called a letter, and there's some question about whether it's accurate or not. But he said that there were 100,000 Jews taken to Egypt by Ptolemy, and probably true. There were a lot of them had settled down there, and a lot of them were taken captive down there. Supposedly, he took 100,000 and made 30,000 of them soldiers. It was kind of mixed treatment up in Palestine, but down in Egypt, they were pretty well treated by the Ptolemies and the ruling class down there. Large population of Jews in Alexandria. Alexandria had 5 zones or districts, and one of those was all Jewish, and the other 4 had some Jewish people in it, and some people estimate as much as 1/4, 1/3 of the population of Alexandria were Jews. Famous library and lighthouse at Alexandria, and presumably, you know, this is again something that's argued whether it's fact or not, the Septuagint version of the Bible was originated there. Ptolemy II really liked the library, and he wanted, you know, the best stuff in there, and he had heard about the Jewish religion and the Jewish scriptures, and he wanted a copy of that in his library. So he sent up to Jerusalem and asked them to send some people down and translate that Hebrew Bible into Greek. Now here's where things get a little fuzzy. Supposedly there were 72 authorities sent down, 6 from each tribe. And one version of the story is that they were each given an assignment either to go off and translate the whole thing or to go off and respond to some questions and then come back and see if they agreed. Well, they all agreed. Miraculously, they all came back with the same answer. Anyway, these 72 eventually translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek, and that became the Septuagint. And it's called 70. Roman numeral 70 for some reason. I don't know how you got from 72 to 70, but that's what it was called then. Hebrew had fallen into disuse. They went into Babylon, went into Persia, they weren't reading. When Ezra read to him, somebody had to explain the meaning, presumably had to translate from Hebrew so that they could understand what he was reading. But they were using Greek, pretty much, by this time. So they could now read the scriptures. I mean, they could read about things that they were missing out on. Most of the quotations in the New Testament are from the Septuagint. Scholars say that, I don't know. But the Ethiopian eunuch was reading Isaiah from the Greek Bible. Under the Seleucids, they were granted religious freedom initially by Antiochus III. He was, when the Seleucids finally took over, he was the guy in charge. Let's see. Yeah, they've got to bring a look into it. They, they were exempted from taxes for 3 years and exempted from 1/3 of the taxes going forward. That's a pretty good break in those days. That turned around later, but initially. Also, they didn't tax the temple people. So that was a pretty good deal for them. Antiochus had been successful in the East. He captured a lot of people, expanded the church, and he thought that he could go and take on Greek. It wasn't a good idea. So who was the guy that had the elephants went over the Alps? All right. He came over. He'd been defeated by the Romans, but he came over and started up some trouble. He said, "I think we together can whip those Romans." You know? So anyway, it wasn't a good idea. They were soundly defeated. What realm he had was curtailed, shrunk. In fact, he had to give up territory where he got most of his taxes from. So they took away a lot of his tax base and increased his taxes, which that didn't help a lot. I think it's about this time that he sent Antiochus IV up to Rome, kind of as a hostage, to make sure that they would pay the taxes every year. Okay? So to pay the taxes, pay the duty to Rome, he raised taxes and robbed temples. So he would go around and, he didn't distinguish between pagan temples and Jewish temples. He eventually came around to try to take treasure. The temples, presumably in those days, were kind of like banks are today. Kind of like, to some extent, safety deposit boxes. That people would bring their precious jewels and gold and stuff and put them in the temple. Not so much the Jewish temple, but the pagan temple. So there was where you could get a lot of stuff. If you needed some gold or some money, you could go rob a guy's temple. So, they tried that on the Jews. They rebelled. Some of them got killed. Antiochus himself was killed during the robbery of one of the temples. This is where Antiochus IV was sent to Rome. Seleucus became king, and I guess Antiochus, I believe, was maybe his son or brother. Anyway, he was sent off as a hostage, if you will, to Rome. Then he was killed. So Antiochus comes back and became king, even though he shouldn't have, because Seleucus IV had two sons. So properly, one of those sons should have become king. But there was a guy named, whose name I can't remember right now, became a regent. Can't find his name. Some guy became a regent for these two sons, and he hoped that maybe he could take over. So he's the one that actually killed Seleucus IV. But he'd forgotten about Antiochus IV. And Seleucus IV, before he died, he actually sent one of his sons up to take Antiochus IV's place. And he was on his way back when his minion killed him. So a lot of killing went on back in those days. So initially, they had a pretty good relationship. I mean, he was a kind of a glad-handing kind of guy. He went around, schmoozing people rather than fighting people, and he dealt with the Jews, and they got along pretty well. But it came time to do two things: cough up the money, and also he wanted to Hellenize his whole realm. And that's where things got pretty bad. The Hellenistic Jews began to adopt Greek customs, names, and practices, and this is kind of the foundation for the Sadducees. They were more liberal. They only accepted the first five books of the Bible. They didn't believe all those prophets and that kind of stuff. And they were easily swayed, I guess, by the Hellenistic principles. But the Hasidim were the pious ones, and they tried to follow the scriptures, if you will. So over time, each one had their own army, more or less, and they fought with each other a lot. I think we talked about this last week. Okay, we go back to Daniel 8. Then the he-goat became very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and in his place came up four outstanding ones toward the four winds of heaven, and out of one of them came forth a little horn, which became very great toward the south, the east, and toward the bountiful land that is Israel, or Judah. And it became great even to the host of heaven, and it made fall some of the hosts of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the ruler of the host, and the daily sacrifice was taken away by him, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Now, looking at Antiochus II or Epiphanes, this pretty well describes what he did. And that's why most people think that this applies to Antiochus Epiphanes. Some people think Well, it was wrong. And some people say, well, part of this prophecy of Daniel applies to Epiphanes up to point, and then it switches over to Rome. But anyway, I think for our purposes, we're going to think that it pretty well is talking about Epiphanes. That same thing? Well, you know, this continues on. And I'm going to go one slide I want to get to before we're not going to finish up. Between the Testaments 1, but we'll continue next week. He considered the high priesthood a political office. Politics. And I'm the head guy, so I'll decide who gets the high priest job. And in those days, the guy who paid the most money usually got the job. So that's kind of what he thought. But Onias 3, don't know how he got the job, whether he paid for it, but he was pretty well an Orthodox Jew. He was a high priest. And his brother Jason was an outright Hellenist. And he offered Antiochus a lot of money, and he got the job. Antiochus was a lot of the Jews. But it wasn't near as bad as when later Epiphanes appointed Menelaus, who was even more Hellenistic than Jason. And he wasn't even of the priestly tribe. He didn't come from Onias. He had no credentials lineage-wise to be the high priest. So while Antiochus was down trying to capture Greece, he organized an army and went against Jason, but was not successful. When Antiochus came back, Menelaus became even more his buddy, and he actually took him into the temple and gave him a lot of the treasures that were there. So that's the kind of guy that Menelaus was. We don't have time maybe to read all of this, but this is from the book of the Maccabees, number 1, and it's the edict that presumably was put out by Antiochus Epiphanes that the king sent word from skipping on down to Jerusalem and town of Judah to follow the practices foreign of the country and put a stop to burnt offerings at the sanctuary, to break the Sabbath, profane the feast, pollute the sanctuary, build all altars and sacred precincts and idol temples, sacrifice hogs and unclean cattle, leave their sons uncircumcised, defile themselves with every unclean and profane practice, so that they might forget the law and change all their religious ordinances, and anyone who did not obey the command of the king should die. So that's pretty hard for some of the Hellenists. They didn't mind too much, but for the Hasidim, this was very hard. And I think we'll stop there. Let me just go through this list. Here's what that led to, if you will. He identified God with Zeus. He placed an image of Zeus on the temple altar. Swine were sacrificed on the altar. Jewish religious practices forbidden. They ordered the scriptures to be destroyed. He converted the name Jerusalem to Antiochia. I didn't stay very long. Built a big gymnasium there in Jerusalem. Tried to institute reverse circumcision. So, began to decree Greek dress and change Hebrew name to Greek name. So that was some of the things that grew out of Epiphanes' edict. And we'll next week start about how the Jews resisted that.